Blog Talk Radio.
Well, this is
if owing to failures of personal integrity, a good system is misused, it can easily become a source of harm rather than a source of benefit. This is a general truth which applies to all fields of human activity, even religion. Though religion certainly has the potential to help people lead meaningful and happy lives, it too, when misused, can become a source of conflict and division. Similarly, in the fields of commerce and finance, the systems themselves may be sound, but if the people using them are unscrupulous and driven by self-serving greed, the benefits of those systems will be undermined. Unfortunately, we see this happening in many kinds of human activities, even in international sports, where corruption threatens the very notion of fair play. Of course, many discerning people are aware of these problems and are working sincerely to redress them from within their own areas of expertise. Politicians, civil servants, lawyers, educators, environmentalists, activists, and so on, people from all sides are already engaged in this effort. This is very good so far as it goes, but the fact is, we will never solve our problems simply by instituting new laws and regulations.
Yes, hello.
Ultimately, the source of our problems lies at the level of the individual. If people lack moral values and integrity, no system of laws and regulations will be adequate. So long as people give priority to material values, then injustice, corruption, inequity, intolerance, and greed, all the outward manifestations of neglect of inner values, will persist.
Well, that's called the new ethic. And he continues with the Christ's new ethic, as he calls it.
I am confident that it is both possible and worthwhile to attempt a new secular approach to universal ethics. My confidence comes from my conviction that all of us, all human beings, are basically inclined or disposed toward what we perceive to be good. Whatever we do because we think it will be of some benefit. At the same time, we all appreciate the kindness of others. We are all by nature oriented toward the basic human values of love and compassion. We all prefer the love of others to their hatred. We all prefer others' generosity to their meanness. And who among us does not prefer tolerance, respect, and forgiveness of our failings to bigotry, disrespect, and resentment?
That's the new book by Dalai Lama.
In view of this, I am of the firm opinion that we have within our grasp a way and a means to ground inner values without contradicting any religion and yet, crucially, without depending on religion. The development and practice of this new vision of ethics is what I propose to elaborate in the course of this book. It is my hope that doing so will help to promote understanding of the need for ethical awareness and inner values in this age of excessive materialism. At the outset, I should make it clear that my intention is not to dictate moral values. Doing that would be of no benefit. To try to impose moral principles from outside, to impose them, as it were, by command, can never be effective. Instead, I call for each of us to come to our own understanding of the importance of inner values. For it is these inner values which are the source of both an ethically harmonious world and the individual peace of mind, confidence, and happiness we all seek. Of course, all the world's major religions, with their emphasis on love, compassion, patience, tolerance, and forgiveness, can and do promote inner values. But the reality of the world today is that grounding ethics in religion is no longer adequate. This is why I believe the time has come to find a way of thinking about spirituality and ethics that is beyond religion.
That's the name of the book, Beyond Religion, by the Dalai Lama. So we're in your territory, Jillian. Thank you very much for being on here. You had spoken to that the other day, but I just want to get a kind of a wrap-up, a kind of summation of how you see things.
Hello?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm not very well. It's very quiet today. But I can hear you, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Yes. So.
Okay.
I was listening to George, and he was talking about some things like that today, and I will punch those up in a minute. But first, I just want to get your take on what do you, how you will address the issues that he spoke about.
What the Dalai Lama was just saying.
Yes, I know.
I think we talked about this the other day, Russell, when he's talking about secular morals, secular values. I am still of the opinion, and I have thought about this since, I'm still of the opinion that even if we could introduce a global set of secular values, moral values, that were acceptable to people who were not people of faith, and I'm talking about faith, not religion, right? Spirituality, the non-spiritual people, even if they had those values, it might make the material life on this planet much improved. It might reduce crime and violence and warfare and so on. But from my perspective, that doesn't matter one way or the other if you don't have faith. And to have faith, you have to, of necessity, accept the potential that everybody has an eternal soul and that life can be immortal and that we should be striving for that level of perfection which Christ demonstrated when he was on the planet and which indeed he advocated and told his disciples. Be ye perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, because it is only when, in my opinion, it is only when it spirit in that way that it has any hope of lasting value or lasting positivity on the planet as a whole, that without faith in that life eternal concept, people will not, no matter what law, what rules or morals or morals you introduce and offer to them, they won't stick with it. Because if they don't have that sense of immortality, they're just going to continue to look at their life and say, okay, I believe in 70 and 10, and then I'm going to be dead. So I want to grab everything I can while I'm here. So this is today, sadly, almost half the planet have no spiritual beliefs, it seems. It appears that way. And that being the case, I don't really see, although the idea is wonderful of secular mores that are moral, right? The idea of it is great, but I really don't see that it would have any deep or lasting value, not without faith.
Okay, faith, the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Hebrews 11:1. So yeah, I understand that. How, when you talk to David and the other people who give you information, what are they saying about some people? And I just say this in passing, Joyce Green, I was listening to him today. He was saying, this planet is the outback of the universe. It's a prison colony. But anyway, we'll get to that in a minute. But how do they view this planet and how we address ourselves and keep up with each other morally, ethically?
I'm sorry, I'm not really, I seem to have a bad line today. I'm not clear what you're asking me. Can you ask me again?
How does David, your guide, see this thing that we are dealing with on this planet?
The general view of the extraterrestrial beings that I'm in contact with is that, the Anunnaki view, right? The Anunnaki view, right, has to be that humanity must be left to itself to take itself to its own conclusion within the time allowed it. And the time allowed for this experiment, if you like, with human beings ruling themselves on this planet, stretched from the time rulership was given to them way back 6,000 years ago, right up until the end of 2025 into 2026. That is the time segment, because at the end of that time segment, there will be cosmic changes, planetary changes, physically real changes in the cosmos due to a regenerative period which occurs roughly every 500 million years or longer. I mean, I don't know exactly, but a very, very long time happens. That every now and then, the universe regenerates itself. It expands out at the rim. It enlarges its territory, so to speak, and it rejuvenates or recreates that which already exists. And it does this by adding in light energy from the central core. And so when these periods in history happen, when these alignments occur, like spokes on a wheel, so that everything is lined up with the central core of our universe, then things change. Now, a historical period for a species could be millions of years between these cycles. It could be a new species starting at the beginning of time and having 500 million years in which to perfect itself. When it comes to humans on this planet, they only became Homo sapien, perfectly developed, about 40,000 years ago. And it took until about 6,000 years ago to bring them up to speed, so to speak, to teach them all the things that they knew, to have a civilization on this planet as human beings. And that then completed itself, that learning curve, if you like, of almost 40,000 years, completed itself about 6,000 years ago. And at that point, the Anunnaki said, okay, we're leaving. We're handing over the planet back to you. It's a human planet. It belongs to you. We've been coming here for a very long time, but now we're leaving again, and we're leaving you to run the planet yourself. And that's what we have been doing for the last 6,000 years, roughly. We've been, as humans, we've been running the planet ourselves. So now we're coming to the end of this time cycle in the cosmos, which is directly nothing to do with us. It's what's happening in the cosmos, but it's affecting us. And the effect is that it draws to a close a time period that Homo sapien has had to develop. This is the period that we had in order to see how we got things. And so the Anunnaki have said from day one that they made a mistake doing the genetic engineering in the first place. They do hope in the future to have the opportunity and intent to fix the problems that they created with the faulty genetic engineering. However, they were quite determined that they were not going to create any more karma for themselves by interfering again, that they were going to wait until the humans, Homo sapien, had reached the end of this historic time period and let basically humans do whatever they wanted up till that time point, and then things will change. So I expect the Anunnaki will be returning in the next 2 or 3 years and offering to help put things right on this planet. Now, when it comes time to do that, and I'm saying it kindly and politely, because by saying, you know, they are going to offer to help, they are not going to interfere, but by taking direct action themselves, that's not their intention. But they do intend to be physically on the planet, connecting with mostly the scientific community and probably the educators to change the way that things are done on this planet. The big problem right now is that we have tyrannical governments, we have fascism all over the place, we have a military-industrial complex, especially here in the United States, but it is pretty well the Western world, that has taken control of all our lives. and is working in collaboration with the new Nazi Fourth Reich, the Germans, who are themselves cooperating and have done since before World War One with the reptilian species. Now, what I want to throw in here is that for thousands of years, the reptilians have been trying to get down onto and involve with planet Earth. And they've had minor successes throughout history, getting one or two people down here and trading with governments in exchange for technological information throughout history, I'm talking about, getting the right to abduct a human being here and there. But they were very small numbers. I remember that, let me say, 50,000 years ago, or less than that even, but about that the number circling our planet, the number of reptilians circling our planet and trying to get down here was 2,000 or 3,000 in ships, in various ships, but not more than 2,000 or 3,000 of them, of their military. And the Anunnaki were always fighting with them. The Anunnaki had been fighting the reptilians for centuries, millions of years probably, but I know for hundreds of thousands of years, certainly. But since World War One, and especially after the beginning of World War Two, the reptilians have been coming down to planet Earth in droves, and more of their species have been filling the space around this planet. It's like they sent word back. I could almost say it like this. When Hitler took power in Germany and Mussolini took power in Italy, and Franco was in Spain, and all these dictators were all over the planet, that made very fertile ground. And it's like the reptilians sent word back to Draco and said, hey, guys, come on over here. The door's open and we're in. And they are in. They were feeding information through the Vril Society to Hitler's government. Indirectly, it went to the Vril Society, and the Vril Society passed it on to Hitler, and Hitler gave them special treatment because of this. And they are still working. They're using the thing where they turn time back, you know, so that group of people are not aging. They just keep working, the same group, under the ice in Antarctica, and they are still working with Hitler and the reptilians. That, not Hitler himself, he actually died, but his group, his Nazi inner party, and many of them are still alive because they did the age regression thing. The Pleiadians are also under there. They have made massive inroads into our planet. This planet belongs to Earth humans, right? And so when the Anunnaki come back, there will need to be a big sorting out with these people, and it's going to be a job getting them out of this territory, digging them out, especially when you consider that the American military, the Army branch of the American military, worked directly through the military-industrial complex with the Nazis and the reptilians. They control almost all our industrial and pharmaceutical bases at this point in our history. So, you know, it's like, I forget who said it. I think maybe it was Eisenhower, but somebody said Hitler lost the battle but won the war. And that's true. He did, because of this inroads into the Western world. And now we see this huge, huge rise of fascism. You know, fascism is tyranny. It's dictatorship. It's when some power person or power group tells everybody else what to do. And we're seeing that returning big time in Europe today. Just last week, one of the leaders of the European community in Brussels announced that she was going to call for a vote to mandate injections for everybody, these COVID jabs. This is fascism. This is the face of tyranny. Governments to tell you what you have to do with your own body. This is tyranny. And This is what the Anunnaki are returning to undo. I know they get a bad rap, and I know since Sitchin died after writing all his books that there has been a whole plethora of people out there bad-mouthing the Anunnaki because they'd made a lot of mistakes in the past and were a bit crazy and did use atomics and all these things. It's not that they're not saying true things. They are, but they're misunderstanding the whole, can I say, concept behind the Anunnaki view. And the Anunnaki view is essentially, one, they lived on this planet during the time of Atlantis and Lemuria. Two, they came back and lived on this planet later and developed Homo sapiens. They have a long-term history with this planet. Some of them want to come and live here again. Some of them don't. About half of them are going over to Andromeda, but a large number of them are intending to live on this planet. But they're a large number in the sense of a few hundred. In other words, a drop in the bucket compared to the human population that exists on this planet. And they are not the ones who are saying we need to depopulate everybody. That's coming out of the Pleiadians and the government. They are not the ones who said the planet was only engineered for 500 million. That, again, is the Pleiadians saying that. So let's get the information straight here and see who is on our side as Homo sapiens and who is not. And I essentially, apart from the Anunnaki, who I know personally, I essentially question every other extraterrestrials, particularly the reptilians, because, but also I include the Pleiadians, because despite all their pseudo-spiritual talk about greetings from brotherhoods and goodness knows what, they are actually, they have the same agenda as the reptilians. They want to control this planet. And I don't happen to think that's right, especially as they want to put large numbers of their people on this planet. So my friends are against that. They are definitely preparing to throw the reptilians and others out.
So we there's battle, there's war, there's conflict, there's animosity. I mean, this goes on and on and on, even among the entities visiting this planet, so to speak, right?
Right.
It continues.
Right.
So what are you going to do about it? I mean, what is it to do?
The battle between right and wrong will never end. The battle between the dark and the light forces will never end, so long as there is one dark force there. So long as there is one wrong force there, because they're all getting away from the teachings of Christ, which was the teaching of perfection, perfect balance, perfect balance. Have you ever done that thing, Russell, with a bar magnet? You take a bar magnet and you put it on the table with the iron filings, and you know the iron filings go to the left and go to the right. You know how that works. Well, then you take some copper wire and you wind it round the ends of the magnet. And then you put the iron filings down again and they all go to the center. And they go 10 times as high shooting out as they ever did from the sides. In other words, they go to the zero point, the point of perfect balance, the God point, if you like. And from there, the energy is 1,000 times greater than it is from either of the other points. Well, that's the difference between all these extraterrestrials who want to control planet Earth, and not all of them do. Some, but those who don't. Now, here's an interesting thing. Apart from the Anunnaki, who've had a living interest in this planet, indeed, they were the ones who opened it up to space. After the great explosion that created the asteroid belt, and she essentially quarantined us from the rest of the universe. And it was the Anunnaki who opened that back up and came to live here, and lived here for several thousand years. They're not newcomers to this planet. They've lived on this planet a lot longer than we have, for example. And when they came back needing the gold and did the genetic engineering, that was not their first visit to this planet by any means. It was a return to this planet, and they do intend to return again. However, apart from them, you can look at all the other lists of extraterrestrials, some of whom send small exploratory groups to visit Earth, and they stay a few weeks or months and they leave again. Or you can say they are just observing us as they fly by, and they send through contacts they have on Earth, maybe messages of information or greeting or something nice, right? They are the ones who are not interested in controlling. Those who wish to control come here, plant themselves here, and never leave. And there are only two major groups that have done that in the last several million years, and that is the reptilians and the Pleiadians. And the Pleiadians have been coming here ever since Homo sapiens was developed. They were not here before that. They came after Homo sapiens developed because they find us useful. And I have to say that there's no way that they do not know about all the abductions and use as slave labor that has taken place with humans over the last, particularly the last, let's say, couple of hundred years. Certainly in the last 50 or 60 decades, tens of thousands of humans have been snatched off this planet and put into slave labor, either by the Germans in their slave labor camps under Antarctica, where they have their huge factories, and that's all written about in and documented in Dr. Sala's books about Antarctica, or taken off the planet and sold into slavery by the reptilians to other locations like the mining bases on Mars or much farther afield even than our solar system. Nobody knows how far they've gone. And so that is worth remembering, because the Pleiadians, for all their sweetness and light language and for their capability of turning back time and doing all the things that they can and do with our military and have demonstrated their capability, have still done nothing to stop the reptilians. And
but
we need to remember that, I think.
But who has?
The Anunnaki have been fighting them for thousands of years, but the Anunnaki are not on the planet right now. But they still fight them in space. They still try to, you know, stop them coming here, stop them doing the things they're doing.
Well, here's a big question. Big question. Would you agree with me, based on research, Dr. Sala, Coy Good, David Wilcox, of John Lear, I mean, we can go down the list of the people who have been doing research. Your late husband, George, your partner who has crossed over, George Green. I mean, can we agree that there are tens of thousands of underground bases with hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people working in the slave camps? And you talked about Delphi, remember?
Yes, I would think that is very, very likely, because Dr. Sala's work is so well documented. And I am sure that what he and Mr. Good and the others talk about is just the tip of the iceberg. When you consider that it is the American military that are working with that group in Antarctica, the Pleiadian group in Antarctica, and organizing our military-industrial complex in cooperation with them, I am sure that that is just the tip of the iceberg, that yes, it's going on all over.
So
it's not just one place.
Okay, great.
So
okay.
we have to wait and watch through this next, from the present through until the next 18 months, 2 years, as it brings itself to a conclusion, because as things open up, as more whistleblowers come out, as more of these cover-ups are exposed and the lies are made known, people can't help but become more and more aware. And of course, this is what George was trying to do when he was out there working, try to make people wake up and see that almost everything their government is telling them is not the truth, right? It's a fabrication. It's an illusion. I guess we all need to watch that movie. What was it called? The Matrix, right? we're kind of like, except I don't think we're in jars and have electronics operating us, but in a way, it's like The Matrix in that everything that we believe is true is probably false. That most of the things that the government tells us, any government, anywhere in the world, is not true. And, you know, going back to what the Dalai Lama said right at the beginning today about having a secular morality that everybody could subscribe to with no reference to religion at all, which in principle is a good idea, right? But having said that, unless people can first understand that what they already know is not correct, what good is it going to do if you just add new rules on top of old lies? The lies have to be uncovered first and people held accountable. You know, ultimately, we're all responsible for ourselves. So there has to be accountability. And the people who have been doing all this manipulation of humanity for a very long time have to be brought to account. They have to be made to account for their behavior and be held responsible for it. You know what they'll all try and do is, of course, they'll be jumping on spaceships and trying to get away to Mars or somewhere before they can be caught. But we see this in our politics on a regular basis, how lies get uncovered day after day. It's no longer shocking to us that politicians lie to us all the time. We take it for granted. You know, we've become so kind of depleted in our own standards that we accept low standards from all these people who govern us, and we need to stop. The stop starts with the individual. Okay. Each and every one of us needs to be accountable for our own behavior.
Let me do this. George Green talked about there are people walking around with no souls. They don't have souls. They're clones.
That's right.
All right, yeah. Here's the way he says it, and I'll let you address the issue. Here's the way he says it.
Yeah, probably. I don't know, but his wife gave me all the data on the different clones. I got papers and papers of them. Another doctor that was in charge, the extraterrestrials shared the information with a doctor down in Albuquerque, and they contacted me because I was publishing all the books exposing the bad guys and all the things that are going on. He contacted me. He says, I got it all. We talked on the phone. I said, I'll fly down on Thursday. I talked to him on Tuesday. On Thursday, they picked him up and put him in a mental institution and gave him and basically electroshock, and he's a vegetable today. Now, well, I told you about 4.5 years ago when I lived here in Vegas, I was contacted by the ETs. I said, look, I've been, like, for the last 10 years, I've been publishing books exposing the bad guys, right? You know what the ETs said? What good has that done? It's okay to know all this stuff, but what's the solution? The solution is written in those little books. That's the reason why they're more important. And I give them away. The reason why I give away the handbook, and you probably heard me on Coast to Coast, I gave 35,000 of them away one night. And we're not going to have a planet left unless we do this. That's how serious it is. I know what's good. I sat in on the meetings on planning on annihilating all you people. I mean, I sat with the governor of Colorado, and he says, I got my ticket. I said, what ticket? Yeah. He said, I'm sitting in the office with one of the Skull and Bones members, and I'm sitting with the governor, and I said, what ticket? And he said, well, and then we went into the underground facility in Australia. You've heard of that in Pine Gap that the Rockefellers built for 35,000 people? I don't have my ticket. They, when they're getting ready to go, they got a facility because they know the Northern Hemisphere is going to have it in spades. So does that mean for you to run to the Southern Hemisphere? Well, 4 weeks ago, a good friend of mine, Brian O'Leary, the Apollo astronaut, has moved to Ecuador. He's in the Valley of Longevity. He says, I know what's coming down. He also knew we never made it to the moon. Another lie.
Okay. Listen, I'm going to turn it over to you. Now, I want to talk about cloning. I'm going to talk about, did they make it to the moon or did they not make it to the moon? Real key subject matters here. And obviously all of them lie to us. And I can go back in history and we'll talk about that in a minute. Right?
Yes. We've been lied to every which way.
But let's talk about that.
Okay. Well, let's talk about cloning, right?
Okay.
There is cloning. The cloning George was talking about, and that which the government currently does, right, where they clone all the top people, you know, and they do, right? And they keep them at, I think it's said the second floor of Bethesda Naval Hospital is devoted to the clones. And yes, George did know the doctor, a lady doctor, who at that time was responsible for looking after the clone people. Right? Those clones that the government develops do not have any transfer of soul energy. So they are soulless beings. Once they've been cloned, their clone has no soul energy. They have the capability of transferring memory, and they have the capability of transferring all the things that the brain function does. But your brain is not your soul, right? And they cannot transfer, the government cannot transfer soul energy. It's much the same as we said the other day about the government teaching people to do remote viewing. And I said, yes, but that's not what a clairvoyant does, even though they can, right? It's different because, as I said then, a clairvoyant understands the emotions and motives with regard to whatever it is they're seeing, where the government people can only observe and record exactly what's in front of them. And it's the same with the cloning. Government cloning cannot transfer soul energy. Now, the Anunnaki use a form of cloning rather than age regression. They continue to live, and when they need a new form, they create a new body, a clone. But they have the capability of transferring the entire energy of a person, all their frequencies, including their soul's frequency, into the new clone. So they are quite different. When George also talked about people being soulless, those people do exist on the planet. There are those, the American Indians call them non-people, the non-people. And the non-people have no soul energy in them. They are entirely biological entities. They are the produce of nature. They look just like you and me, but they have been born without any soul energy. How that's possible, I don't know, but I do know that they exist. And when you can see it when you really look into their eyes. It is true, the eyes are the windows of the soul, and when you look into their eyes, you can see they have no life spark within them. It simply isn't there. So that's cloning. As to going to the moon, When yes, we did get to the moon at one point, and we were told never to go back again because there was somebody there before us. But we didn't go to the moon at the first time when we were told, and that we went. And how I am fairly sure of that is because at the time that it happened, that we were supposed to be landing on the moon, a friend of George's, who was at NASA, he called up and told George, he said, okay, George, switch on your television. And George said, what for? He said, I'm just going to put in a disc. And it was in the days of VCRs then, you know, those kinds of things. So it wasn't a disc, it was a VCR tape. I'm just going to put in the tape of us, quote, landing on the moon. You'll be interested to watch it. So a tape had been created, and I understand most of it was created at Pinewood Studios in England. Whether that's correct or not, I'm not sure, but that's what I was given to understand. And somebody, I forget who, wrote a book about it called The Paper Moon. And interestingly enough, I remember this when it was happening, right? And when the NASA pictures came out, one of the earliest photographs, you could actually see the studio line at the back where they had blacked it out, a black curtain with pinholes in, supposedly to look like space. But the space ended in a straight line, and then there was something above it on the screen because the photograph had included something beyond the set that they'd set up. So I think there's probably a lot of truth in the fact that we didn't go to the moon when we said we did. I'm pretty sure that we went at a later date.
All right. Let's say that, okay, the moon is not a planet. It's a command center, right?
I don't know that. I don't know that.
Well,
that's not my understanding. It is a command center. That's true. It's a command center. But it is also a moon.
But it's not a planet.
It's a tidally locked, you could say, planetoid. And it's tidally locked. It just shows one face to us. That's to do with the gravitational fields that hold it in place. And as far as I'm concerned, that the moon is the end result of a very ancient collision, prehistory, long, long ago. But it is in the cosmology of the Anunnaki from most ancient times, when a great planet came into this system and collided with another planet. And what we ended up with was our Earth and a piece of the other planet of Kingu tied to us in an orbital, tidally locked orbit, which was the moon. So for me, it's not, I know George said, and I know several people have said that it's a man-made artifact, but I don't agree with that. But that's just because I read a different history, maybe. But from pre-Sumerian history, that is not a man-made object. It is true that it is a command center for extraterrestrials and our military. That's true.
Okay. So there are other entities living on the moon who have been to the moon and who control the moon, and that's why you say they ask us, don't come back here again. Is that what you hear?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that. The sound is very muffled.
It is very muffled.
I didn't hear what you
said. They said, don't come back here anymore. They told the aliens.
Yes.
Okay.
When we first went, there were people already there, and essentially they told our astronauts, leave and don't come back.
Okay.
Our astronauts
didn't report that to the public because we've always been bamboozled, lied to, deceived. Ever since, let's go back to 1938, right? Orson Welles, Wars of the World, where people panicked in the street because he had a radio show that they thought was real. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
Okay, well,
little at the time, but yes, I remember.
Well, the people who don't remember that, here's a clip.
On the evening of the 30th of October, 1938, Orson Welles directed and narrated a radio adaptation of The War of the Worlds, the novel by H.G. Wells, as part of the Mercury Theatre on the Air. Despite its relatively low audience figures, the broadcast subsequently became famous for causing mass panic amongst American citizens that the events were fictitious, but it was clear that these warnings had gone unheeded by many. Although the listening figures themselves were relatively small, news of the alien invasion spread through a country that was nervous about impending war in Europe. Within hours of the broadcast, the billboards in New York's Times Square were flashing with reports of mass panic caused by the radio play.
And according to the CIA, the FBI, and the Majestic 12, and the people who happened to operate the Black Ops program and the trillions and trillions of dollars that nobody has any control over but them, and they say that we didn't want to tell people that we know aliens live on this planet and been living on this planet and abducting people and all that, and we're happen to be exchanging technology for the bodies of the individuals, and we are taking them to other planets. Because there's a special report called the Proposed Studies of the Implications of Peaceful Space Activities for Human Affairs that was done in the 60s by the Committee on Science and Astronautics. But anyway, I won't go through it, except to say if you read it, a special report, that if we discover that there are aliens on this planet, don't tell people, because if they can't handle the truth, they will panic like they did in 1938. What do you say to that?
I say that's stupid, because the world is not the world of 1938. People are no longer that ignorant. We have the internet, we have television, and we've had it essentially since World War II, and people are no longer unaware of extraterrestrials. In fact, I believe at the last big, you know, poll that was done, 52% of people in America actually believe there are extraterrestrials and that they are in contact with our government. So you already have, even in just a casual poll, more than half the people accepting the concept of extraterrestrials.
But the government,
so
would say
I don't
this.
Think that people would panic. I think they would panic. Right.
Did they panic?
I think they would be made to panic by the government telling them that the extraterrestrials were invading us and we all needed to get ready to fight, right? When in reality it would, and I can see them doing that. I see that they may well that line when it comes to the realization by our government that they are on the way out, that they are losing, that they are no longer, I mean, you imagine somebody like Miss Pelosi, right, going out there, she'd be one of the first to say, no, 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 it's not us, it's the evil extraterrestrials, and you all have to be ready to fight them. And I think the government will use the panic thing, create the panic, in order to get control again, to have an excuse to bring in martial law, and when they realize that they're on a losing end of the stick, that they are at the losing end of the game, they are going to be brought down in the very near future. They cannot, this lying control that the fascist governments have generally, and I include some of our government in that, right, they cannot continue for much longer. It is coming to an end, and when it comes to an end, there will be panic because it will be created by those people who are losing out in order to try and hang on to control, which they won't succeed in doing. But will we end up with something like 1938 where people were jumping out of tall buildings and killing themselves? No, I don't think that will happen. I don't think people are that stupid. I think we have a pretty smart population of intelligent people. The fact that a lot of people don't know or have knowledge of some of the things that maybe you and I might talk about or other people talk about, the fact that they have never heard of it or don't know it does not make them stupid people. It just makes them people without knowledge. And that kind of knowledge about what is really going on, both on and off the planet, is becoming more abundant every single day as more and more truth comes out and more of these whistleblowers are speaking out. Respected authors like Dr. Salah are writing books with documentary evidence in them. They're sure. coming out with programs on the television. You know, the Ancient Aliens program, these kinds of shows that are highly intelligent, that people like to watch. And so every day we are getting more and more informed people in the population. So that now I believe it's well over half the people are well educated and know what's going on and are really getting ready to say, we've had enough, no more.
But listen, if you were to come to Florida, let's just say, supposition, and you invited to Florida, by the way, but if you were to come and you would be walking down the street with a reptilian who looks like a reptilian, they can shapeshift, of course, and look like a human. But if they were walking down the street with you and they look like a reptilian, what do you think people would do?
I would hope if they saw a reptilian that they would take out, as we would in Montana, one of their little guns and put them into a corner, back them into a corner, and make sure that they were taken away. Because reptilians are very dangerous.
Okay.
Remember
forget that. How about if they were walking down the street with a gray or an insectoid? What would they do?
Well, they're not going to be walking down the street with an insectoid. There are actually very few. No, listen. There are very, very few extraterrestrials who can survive on this planet in the environment that we have.
Okay.
And those that can survive in this environment look just like us.
I disagree.
So you wouldn't know the difference. And
I disagree.
Especially they cannot survive. And if it was the grays, why would a gray expose themselves walking down a street? They wouldn't do it. This is the thing. The ones who are ill-intentioned towards us, and I include the greys in that, the greys are not good guys by any means. They do all kinds of experimental surgeries on humans that they capture, snatch, and take into underground bases. They are not going to expose themselves on a city street. Even if they could manage it, they're not going to do it because they know that they will be set upon and killed. And quite rightly, too, because almost everybody...
I love this.
Everybody who knows about extraterrestrials knows the greys are bad.
Well, how about the Pleiadians? George, he hung out with the Pleiadians. He loved the Pleiadians.
The Pleiadians look just like us. And I'll tell you what, they're a good-looking race. They're like the Nordic people, long blonde hair, blue eyes. And if the Pleiadian female was walking down the street, she'd probably have a dozen good-looking guys following her because they look like these, you know, what Baywatch beauties. The Baywatch beauties, right? So the Pleiadians would have no trouble in wandering about, and I'm sure they do. I'm sure they do wander about in our streets.
Here's another question for you. Since most people have not had contact, they're not a contactee or an abductee, but most people are not, then most people haven't even seen a flying saucer yet that they really identify as a flying saucer. And as a matter of fact, in 1952, there were a number of flying saucers came over to Washington, D.C., and they were buzzing the White House. Listen to this.
UFO researchers have long suspected that a government cover-up has prevented the public from knowing the full story about visitors from other planets. In 1973, for instance, the director of the FBI denied that his agency had ever investigated UFOs.
In 1976, the agency released more than 1,100 pages of UFO information that it had collected over many years. What forced the disclosure? It was the Freedom of Information Act. Tonight, in part three of our series, UFOs, the Best Evidence, George Knapp reports on other secrets that have been pried out of the government.
UFO skeptics often ask, if there are aliens visiting Earth, why don't they announce themselves by flying over the White House? The answer is, UFOs did fly over the White House twice. It happened in July 1952. As the New York Times reported, seven eerie glowing objects were spotted by pilots in the air and people on the ground. 12 different radar operators tracked the UFOs at speeds of up to 7,000 miles per hour. A week later, the objects were back again. When jets were scrambled, the lights either disappeared or zoomed away. The Air Force explained that what everyone had seen was a temperature inversion. To a man, the radar operators disagreed, but the official explanation is the one that stuck. Government explanations of UFOs are often just plain wrong. In 1965, thousands of people from Canada to Mexico watched a formation of UFOs maneuver in the skies. The Air Force said it was the constellation Orion, even though at the time Orion could only be seen from the other side of the planet. A UFO landing at White Sands Missile Base was said to be a sighting of the planet Venus, to which one UFO buff responded, it was unforgettable the night Venus landed on the gypsum flats of New Mexico.
Okay, so story after story after story like that, because there's been a solid denial of the fact that the aliens are here. Harry Truman passed the rule that you're not to discuss this. There's a top, a way above top secret, and he called the group Majestic 12, who took over, and that's what they talk about, that military-industrial complex. All right, talk about that for us. Help us with that.
Yes. It's true that they've had everything kept secret. And Majestic 12, I've forgotten all the people. I used to know about that. I've forgotten all the people who were in it, who were involved in it. But it was, you know, way, way above top secret. Nobody knew. And the president, President John Kennedy, President Clinton, the various presidents, Ronald Reagan, they all tried to get information about Majestic 12, and even Edgar J. Hoover was unable to get the information about what was going on. They wouldn't even let him. And it's a CIA-run operation. Very, very secret. Only a handful of people ever knew it. And it was to hide everything that they knew about extraterrestrials. And the reason for that was because the extraterrestrials were giving information. And the information was technical information. And the technical information was doing two things for the people who had it and who controlled it, creating massive wealth in this world. I mean, billions of dollars value. And it was creating powerful military because it was massive killing power that they were learning about. So they were hanging the group, the Majestic 12 group, were hanging on to this information and simply refusing to let anybody else have access to it for a very long time. Now, this thing about, you know, the public will panic. We have to keep all this information about UFOs secret because the public will panic. That is just their excuse. I do not think the public is that stupid, not in this day and age. I'm sure they're not. But that is their excuse for not sharing it. The real reason is that by not sharing it, they hold on to the power and they hold on to the money that is generated from the knowledge, from that vast amount of technical knowledge. Imagine what somebody like Bill Gates probably paid somebody else to find out how to proceed with his computers, with the technical algorithms or whatever it is that you need in software and so on and so forth. This is all about money. It's like an old, you know, Sam Spade detective novel, Follow the Money. Cherchez la femme and follow the money. And in this case, it's all about follow the money. And yeah, always has been. Power, money, wealth is power. And they're all after the same thing, and that's power. So it's not right, because the public will panic.
Okay. The other thing I want to bring up, that we seem to be in disarray, a dilemma, confused, disrupted as a society. Race against race and women against men and the whole nine yards, Roe versus Wade. This has happened before in Atlantis, right? Years ago. You were there.
Yes.
Weren't you in Atlantis? Tell us about what was happening there before it was destroyed.
Well, it wasn't so much a division of races as it was a massive advance of science that went too far and triggered massive earthquakes. I mean, it was an experiment when it gone wrong, really. Triggered massive earthquakes. And, you know, when men start to try and play God, they get in trouble. And that's what was going on in Atlantis. It was a whole thing with the splitting of the atom and the tearing of life apart without knowing it, how to put it back together, which is what our genetic scientists are doing today, tearing life apart. They haven't a clue how to fit it back together because they're not the creator. And that's just what the Atlanteans were doing. And what they did was have a massive explosion that created super mega earthquakes and destroyed the planet for a period of time, caused Atlantis to sink, created the ice age that followed, caused all of Lemuria practically to go under the sea. All that's left visible of Lemuria is, of course, the Antarctic and New Zealand, parts of Australia, Tasmania. That was all Lemuria at that time. And there's not much of it left. So,
is that about to happen
what
again?
What we do to the planet.
Is the same thing about to happen again?
Except, no. I think there are too many controls, and I think that the people who want the power today don't want the power in that same way. Now they see the luxurious possibilities of life, not only on this planet, but on journeys to the stars, and we know they have these ambitions. Look how many people are paying $1 million to just go up in a spaceship and orbit the Earth once and come back down again. And I think they're paying $1 million or something for a ticket, right? So this desire of people with wealth and power span their horizons and into space. And while they are here on this planet, to have every possible luxury that life can afford on this planet. And I think that's their goal. And in order to fulfill that goal, they need massive, obedient public members to be their slave labor, to work for them in their businesses, in every business you can think of, you know, to work for minimum wage at McDonald's so that whoever owns McDonald's can live in luxury, to work for minimum wage at Walmart so that whoever owns Walmart can live in luxury, to work and maybe earn a decent wage in the tech industry. But for them, they're not making just millions for their owners. They're making billions for their owners. So it's a matter of degree. But behind it all is the necessities for the capitalists, that's those who own the things, to have a massive slave labor available to them that they can use and work to death for just about a living wage or less, right? You don't get rich working for somebody else, or very seldom. There's very few people get rich working for... The only ones that get rich working for somebody else are the politicians. And the politicians theoretically work for the people, and they get a salary, say, of $200,000 a year, for instance. Yet somehow at the end of that year, they managed to have banked $5 million. Now, I don't know what magic the politicians have, but they seem to all get rich when they get elected to Congress, much richer than they ever were before they got elected to Congress. So apart from politicians, most people will not get rich working for somebody else. It's just the capitalists who work those people that get rich. And that just continues. I mean, that's the story of this planet. That's gone on for a very long time, that people have always taken advantage of other people. and there is really nothing that you can think of that can be make it acceptable, the inhumanity of man to man, the way we treat each other, that very few people live by the golden rule of do unto others as you would be done by, which is teaching on this planet. Remember, you know, right back to the beginning when the Dalai Lama was talking about the rules for living. Well, when the Anunnaki handed over kingship, they also gave them a set of rules to live by. And that was one of the rules. Do unto others as you would be done by. Treat your brothers as you would be treated. Take care of your neighbor. These were the rules that were laid down for man in the beginning by the Anunnaki. And they were first encoded at the time of Hammurabi, in the codex of Hammurabi. He made a codex that spelled out all these rules. And those rules, the codex of Hammurabi, I'm not sure if that's the right pronunciation. Those rules, that codex, is the foundation of the American Constitution that the founders of the Constitution used to base their concepts on. And according to the guys off planet that I talk to, they say that the greatest document ever written for the governance of man is the American Constitution. That what was written out for us as a constitution is perfect for governing the people on this planet. And what is it including? Things like, you know, the right to defend ourselves, the right to take care of ourselves, the pursuit of happiness, all these things. We add the Bill of Rights and you've got everything a man could want. And it is for this reason that the evildoers in our governments variously have introduced things like Patriot Act 1, Patriot Act 2, again, using these tactics like, oh, we can't tell you about UFOs because you'll panic. Well, we can't let you keep your freedoms because it will allow a terrorist to arrive in the country and blow something up. And even if we have to blow something up ourselves to let you see what it will be like if the terrorists do it, gee, we have to protect you. So we have to suspend your Bill of Rights. We have to suspend your constitutional rights. We have to have the Patriot Act 1 and reinforce it with Patriot 2 and take away your rights. And don't think it doesn't. Don't think I'm exaggerating. I was once at an airport and the person in front of me was being, quite frankly, a bit obnoxious. It's true. But they said to the TSA person, I know my rights. And the TSA person turned around and said, sir, since the Patriot Act, you don't have any rights. The Bill of Rights is true. We don't have any rights right now. And yet our Constitution, by the Anunnaki at least, is considered the perfect document for running the planet. So, you know, well, jump to your own conclusions.
Well, let me say this, that it's been a dilemma ever since, for the last 50 years in terms of hiding disinformation. As William Tompkins says, we all have been lied to. And he was hiding the information for at least 60 years or 70 years, but he just left a couple of years ago. Of course, Colonel Corso in the book, after the day after Roswell, has a lot of disclosures. People should, you know, really look at that book. Another book a motion picture, if you will. Remember Taken by Steven Spielberg?
Yes.
Remember that 13-hour series
excellent.
That you, huh?
Yes. Excellent film.
It's available on Amazon, but I guess you can go to YouTube and watch it. But would you say that 90% of all that information in that 13-hour series was right on target?
Yes, I would. It
okay.
Really is a very, very good depiction of a lot of the stuff that goes on. It's excellent.
Okay. One of the things, too, was the central core of that motion picture was that the young lady at the end who had to go back to the planet, or leave this planet because she couldn't, whatever, adjust here because of her abilities to do a lot of things like remote viewing and mental telepathy and on and on and on and on, and that she had to get out of here. But she was conceived on a spaceship. Is that right?
In the story, she was, yes.
Yeah, but isn't that happening today? That
yes.
the conceptions, yes or no?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, that happens.
Okay, but why?
Why not?
Do you continue? Oh, okay, why not? Like the sons of man, the gods look down and said, oh, boys, they look good, let me get down here and have fun. But I'm saying that continues, right? That's a continuation.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Whether it be on a spaceship, whether it be on the plantations of America, it has always happened, whether it be underground bases, not only in Antarctica, but other places, Delta or wherever, but on Mars and other parts of the universe. It's happening, yes or no?
Yes, I
okay.
would say so. I would say that there is enough evidence to suggest that, yeah, your statement is correct.
Okay.
Do I know that personally? No, but do I think that it's probably correct? Yes.
Okay. Here's my question of you. When is that going to be cleaned up a little bit, so to speak?
Well, you're talking about more than one thing here. You're talking about things like the Greys and the abductions by the Greys to underground bases and the abductions to Mars for slave labor. Those are quite different things that you're talking about. And then you're talking about when you go on a spaceship. Well, you know, I guess sex is as good on a spaceship as it is on a planet, right? So some people go voluntary and enjoy it. Right, they're not all abductees by any means, and I can vouch for that. So, kid, don't kind of get confusion here. I do not think that they are taking Mars people all the way to Mars in a breeding program, because the breeding programs have been going on for centuries, quite successfully down here on the planet. And some of those people in the breeding programs, most of them have been the Greys doing this experimental work. But some of them, I have to admit, were the some of the Anunnaki, the Ajiji, who stayed behind 5,000 years ago or 6,000 years ago when the Anunnaki left. There were a number of the astronauts who were down on the planet at the time who had married Earth women and had families, including Lord Marduk himself. He was on the planet. Now, I know a person here, a gentleman called James Gilliland, and he's a highly respected writer and researcher and longtime contactee who has a place called Aseti over on the Washington, Oregon border, almost over into Oregon. And he has UFOs on his property every night. I mean, I've seen them. I was there with George, and yes, they do come, and the golden balls and the colored balls flying around. And there's pretty much a display on a regular basis over on this property. He has coming out of a mountain called, I think it's called Mount Adams. So James is very well known. And when I said to him one time, I thought that maybe Marduk was getting a bad rap on this planet, his response was that he's a terrible, terrible person. And he is the one person on this planet that you wouldn't want to run into on a dark night because he would terrorize you to death, right? Well, that may be true. I don't know. It's a long time since I've seen Marduk. And I know he's the black sheep of the family and one shouldn't connect with him, but he's also a very charismatic member of the Anunnaki. And when he had a wife and children, an Earth wife and children as a family on this planet 6,000 years ago, when all the rest were hightailing it home, he and a few of his Air Force, he's a GG, would not leave. They would not leave their families. And it was Marduk, as the son of Enki, who was also instrumental in saving the human species from the Great Flood. So how actually evil that makes him, I don't know. I know that he's always been a supporter of humanity. He's one of the ones who definitely wants to return to this planet. I think we might be surprised when he actually gets here and we see how he behaves. But, you know, it is interesting that we talk about these beings without actually knowing them, that they're not personal to us. They're somebody we've seen in a film or read about in a book, but we don't know them. I guess the reason that I am very often in disagreement with super people like James Gilliland, who I recommend his books and his website and his location, a city. I highly recommend it. He's super smart and has lots of valuable information. And he does have a good website with a newsletter on it that anybody might enjoy, right? So this is nothing against James. But we were clearly on different pages when it came to Marduk. Well, I think the reason I'm often at variance with friends and people alike on these issues is because these people are real to me. They're my family. They're my Anunnaki family. I have known them for more time than I care to remember. And I'm actually a relative of Marduk's. So maybe that makes me a bad person as well by default, just by being related. I don't know. But I know them personally. And so when I speak of them, I'm just speaking of just in the same way as you would speak of members of your family. You know, people that you really know on a very close personal level. And that's how I think of them. Generally speaking, I call them JC and the boys, which it sounds a bit irreverent, but that's how I know them all. They have never been strangers to me. And so I maybe have a different view than a lot of people about.
The views that you are expressing that most of us have never heard, quite frankly, the people who are listening to this program. So this is material that most people have probably taken with a grain of sand and salt, if you will, and throw it away. They're not even going to deal with it. But
I wouldn't blame them. If I was listening to me and I didn't have any background knowledge, I wouldn't believe a word I was saying. Because it sounds far-fetched. That's why I'm being personal here and saying, but I know these people personally, and that's why I say the things about them that I do.
All right, well, tell me, who is David then? And you have a long-term relationship with David for many, many,
yes.
many
years. David,
let's talk about him
I call him David because he left home and took on the role, was birthed as a human, and took on the role of the biblical King David. And that was a role he played in recent history, just a few thousand years ago. Prior to that, in Atlantean times, he was known as Thoth the Atlantean and was one of their top scientists. In more recent history, he was known as Thoth the Egyptian, the moon god. He was also known by the Greeks as Hermes Trismegistus. This is all one and the same person. And more ancient history, he is the second son of the Enki, and his epithet is Ningishida, which means Lord Gish of Sheba. And he was given that title because the science laboratories were developed in what is now East Africa, but was then known as the Land of Sheba. And because of the work he did down there, he was given the title Lord Gish of Sheba, which is in Anunnaki Ningishida. That's who David is.
Okay, but he did tell you something recently. What did he say to you recently, in the last few weeks? What did he say?
Nothing much. I haven't heard from him for 2 or 3 months now. I can't remember what I told you, what the last thing was. Oh, he said that August of this year, this month, yeah, we're in August now, that during this month, there would be changes, events. He called them events. There would be events occurring on this planet that would change things across the face of the globe, and that they were good things that were coming. They were beneficial events. I asked him, of course, as you would naturally, what are these events? And as usual, he said, well, I'm not going to tell you because you'll think of it, and by thinking about it enough, you'll change it. So we're not telling you. But we are 98.9% sure these events will occur during the month of August. So I am, like everybody else, waiting to see what these events are, and I hope that I recognize them when they occur.
Okay.
All I mean, right. I told everybody. I told everybody I knew, you know, that this was what he said.
No, I think it's,
so
it's important. You tell
now us. Now we're all waiting. Now we're all going down to the coffee shop and saying, have you heard of anything yet? Have you heard of anything? We're
well,
all
of course.
Waiting. We're well, all,
of course. Everybody's good. Everybody wants to know what's going to happen because we seem
right.
to be in disarray. We seem to be a divided
right.
people here on this planet called Earth, right? And we're wondering
yes.
what's
beautiful,
going to
happen. Beautiful planet.
Yeah, but
beautiful planet.
Well, wait a minute now. I'm just saying, yeah, of course. But look, we have a lot of unemployment. We have people who are starving to death. They don't even have good water. But 30-40% of the people on the can't get a good drink of water, right? Healthy water.
Right.
People starving to death, should be starving. They don't have
yeah.
any food, right? Africa,
yes.
South America, wherever we go. I mean, India. So we do have a problem. How do we begin, just in some small sense of the word, to resolve some of these issues? How do we
well,
do that?
The only way that this will ever be solved, there is, of course, the obvious thing of depopulation, you know, reduce the population, as China did successfully by having a period of time when they only had one child per family, that helped solve the food problems in China, but that's really not a necessary idea. What we actually need is twofold. We need to stop being afraid of everything. We're all controlled by our governments through fear, not love. The government doesn't love you. They want you to be afraid of them. And any government, anywhere in the world, rules through fear, not love. So we need to get rid of fear out of our lives, always thinking that somebody else is just out there dying to do something bad to us. And we are all conditioned to this. How many people think that when they take their car into the car mechanic, that the car mechanic is going to overcharge them or tell them that it needs something that it doesn't need doing, right? I mean, this is such a trivial example, but it shows you how deep our level of fear of each other goes. So when it's fear of somebody in another country, especially if that other country has the same kind of weapons that we have, right? My goodness, then we're all afraid of them. You know, so we have to get rid of fear, and equally important, perhaps even more important, we have to get rid of greed. Just sheer greed, because it is not really true that this world cannot comfortably support us all. The problem is that a very, very few have 1,000 times more than they need, and then half of the remainder, I'm talking about maybe 2-3% of the world's population, or the very, very top 1%, let's say, they have far more than they can ever, ever use, right? And then the next level down is more than 50%, the developed world. Most people in the developed world have somewhat more than they can use. Most of the people do. And then that leaves the other half, actually more than half, who have considerably less than they need. Not that they want, but that they need. They don't have enough food. They don't have enough water. They don't have enough anything in which to survive. And so I remember when I was a little girl, my mother used to say, eat your dinner. You've all heard this story from our mothers. Eat it all up. There are children starving in India. Eat your dinner, right? How many of us have heard remarks like that from our mothers in our childhood? Most of us have that had sufficient, right? And many of us have more than we need. And we need to start examining our possessions and realizing that somebody else is going without in order that we can have that surplus. And then asking ourselves the question, so do I really need the surplus? Do I really want this? Do I want this extra luxurious haute cuisine supper at the price of a child going to bed starving tonight in some other part of the world? Because until we get some more sharing among the human population, and this requires that we recognize the essential equality of every single soul on the planet. Nobody is better than somebody else. We all deserve a shot at a decent life. We all deserve an equal opportunity. I am not saying that we all deserve equal things in life, because you will never have that successfully. Some people will always work harder than others. Some people will always be smarter than others. Some people will always be quicker than others, right? That's not what I'm saying. I'm not talking about any form of Russian-style communism, USSR-style communism. What I am talking about is a fairly even level of opportunity for every human being on the planet to make a good life for themselves, whatever their circumstances in general are. So like Christ said, you know, the poor you will always have with you. And it's true. Some people will always get rich. Some people always get poor. You know, the one thing I liked about the kind of socialism that exists in England, when the Labour government first came in 1948, I think it was, the end of the war, and a man called Mr. Attlee became Prime Minister of Britain, and he introduced for the first time, it was a Labour government, Americans would call it socialist, and they introduced the social systems that have existed in Britain since 1948 and still continue today. And those systems included things like health care for everybody. Whether you had any money or not, you could get health care. Didn't mean those with more money couldn't pay for a bit more comfort in a private unit, which they could. But if you didn't have that kind of money, you'd get equally good medical care. And the way they did that, nationalized the health service, introduced the National Health Service, they did it by not making lower paid workers. They tried to pay everybody a living wage, but what they did put is caps on the amount that top people could earn. So as a man, just because he was a doctor, was not going to get a million times more pay than the man who washed the floors. He was maybe going to get 50 times more pay to compensate him for all his years of work and study. By putting caps on the ceiling, instead of letting them make as much as they like and then trying to tax them to death and destruction, what they did was put a cap on their earnings. And that meant that if they were out of the national health system and practicing alone, they could make as much money as they liked. But if they were part of the national health system, there was a limit to the top level of pay. And that kind of thinking went all the way through health, education, family care, you name it. They spread it, and then they encouraged trade unions, which gradually got the wages of the working people in industry raised to a living level. So most people in Britain, even today, you don't find many people with millions and millions like people like Bill Gates or Buffett or these. You don't find people, that politician down in Utah, mega rich people. You don't find many of those in England. But what you do find is the majority of people have a nice home and a wage on which they can live comfortably, in no matter what job they're in. They can live in a nice home and they can pay their bills. Now, Britain has problems like everybody else since World War II, you know, with immigration and all these refugees and things taxing the system.
I think it's continuing. South America, Venezuela.
I'm not saying Britain is utopia, because it's got its problems like everybody else, but its fundamental systems offer a kind of peaceful base opportunity for everybody to have a decent life. And
right.
I think that's really a model that eventually will spread itself over this planet. Then it's not about equalizing money. It's about equalizing opportunity.
Okay.
That has to be available.
What's happening on Mars? What's happening on the moon? What's happening on Pluto or Saturn?
So far as I know, and I only know about the stuff on Mars, I know it from two sources. One, most of the intelligence I have on Mars itself, apart from knowing as an Anunnaki that it's an Anunnaki refueling station and has been for thousands of years. I mean, they had the station closed down. They reopened it. I think it was in either 1991 or 98. Certainly, but in the 90s, they reopened that fueling station. And I do know somebody who went there, so I know that's up and operating and has been for a long time. And in another area of Mars, I was also shown a photograph from a gentleman called Johnson, Ben Johnson. He lives in your area, I believe. And he and a group of his friends around the world are photo experts who find anomalies in photographs of space. And they receive the NASA pictures, the photos that NASA takes. And then they examine these photographs with all their technical equipment to look for anomalies, and then they can blow them up and show them, you know, show what it is when they find anything. And one of the things that I saw that Mr. Johnson has is a photograph of Mars, which is really interesting because there's a man and a woman dressed in like normal looking clothes that you would see down here, you know, jackets and boots and things. Sitting on the ground, leaning back against a rock in the sunshine, just casually leaning back there, holding a conversation. They're talking to each other. No face masks, no oxygen tanks, no spacesuits, no nothing. They're just sitting there leaning against this rock. And it's a NASA picture from Mars that Mr. Johnson has, that he found this anomaly on.
Right.
And so it was a picture taken by a rover. One of the rovers took this photograph, and he examined it and found these people and blew it up. And it's quite plain. I mean, you're not trying to imagine what it is you're looking at. You can see quite plainly what you're looking at. I think it's probably on his website. That's Ben Johnson. And I know he has a website. It's not a relation of yours, is it?
He set up a website, nohoax.net, nohoax.net. So a lot of his information is still up there. I was just looking at it today. That he has a website with a lot of books and a lot of videos and other kind of materials, even your books, The Return of the Anunnaki is there, and ETA and some other kind of thing. Listen, since you're not a friend of the Greys or the Reptilians, so I hear, right? So when we talk about Reagan, he was saying that we got to be cautious about the aliens, that there's an alien presence among us. So when I look at Dr. Greer, who is a surgeon, or was a surgeon, he still is a surgeon, but he's not practicing. He's really out here on the stump with unacknowledged project disclosure and remote viewing and all that thing. But here's what he says that he thinks is coming, that we are going to make, or the powers that be are going to make the alien the enemy so we can start a war with them. So
these people that you see on 60 Minutes, that you see on Fox News and CNN and all the media, this is the ramping up of the false disclosure that we warned about in 1999 when we wrote the paper, When the Disclosure Serves Secrecy. Why? Because they want people to now know that there are UFOs, but they want to put this big lie out there that they are a national security threat and concern, what Nick Pope and others keep saying. By the way, Nick Pope has admitted to two people on my team that he has been paid large sums of money to say these very scripted things in the mainstream media so that he has been able to buy some really pricey real estate in Soho and London and elsewhere. One of my concerns about this is that while I normally do not engage in sort of gossip, is that now that these people are miseducating deliberately the American people and the world on this, it is a very big concern. They have stepped into another level of deception. It's one thing if you're at a UFO conference in front of 1,000 people. It's another thing if there are millions and millions of people hearing this lie. Now, all these people, from Chris Mellon, Luis Elizondo, to Leslie Kane, to Nick Pope, and others, know for a fact, just what I just said, that there are two types of UFO things. Man-made ones, that is the bigger secret, by the way. The ET issue is not as big a secret as the man-made ones, for a reason I'll get into in a moment. And that this is not a national security threat. All the images that you have seen in the mainstream news of the Tic Tac, of these pyramids and triangles, those are all ours. And they were filmed and known at some point they would release it to open the door to this subject. But there's more coming. You saw on the History Channel where the Italian helicopter that crash landed after it had some malfunction, that whole event, we know from Paula Harris, who was there and met with the man who's now the admiral who when it is on that show, said that those were our human classified electromagnetic weapons, that they were attempting to target UFO ET craft that were in the area at the time. She knows this for a fact and documented it. So almost everything you're seeing that's going out through the mainstream media right now is not only a lie, but a damn lie, which is exactly what Wernher von Braun warned about would eventually happen when he told Carol Rosen that in 1974, and of course, which I learned about in the early 90s and have been warning people about since. Unfortunately, we're going to live through this period of this false launch of information. The only way we're going to correct it is for all of you to share this YouTube video with everyone. I don't care if you rip it off the site and post it elsewhere, do it. Because unfortunately, we're at a point now where there is a massive information campaign that is false. And the reason they want people to think all of these are things that we don't know and can't figure out how they fly is so that eventually they can put out more scary information, perhaps next month with the Director of National Intelligence report, showing even more gruesome events that have happened that show, in fact, that these are a threat to the national security. Why? Of course, that with the fascist military industrial and industrialist complex want people to be afraid of something. So this is the next big thing. It's much bigger than 9/11. It's much bigger than COVID. We've been warning about it for some time. Unfortunately, we're trying to see if some people can get pulled off the precipice, including Luis Elizondo. That is why Daniel Sheehan is working with him. Now, I've made it very clear that Daniel Sheehan has told me he would do this, that if he cannot get Luis Elizondo to speak the truth and come clean on this, that he would drop him as a client. He will drop him as a client.
Now, this is Luis Elizondo, who was on 60 Minutes just a few days ago.
When you get that Navy pilot saying what he said, do you think that that was, a UFO, to obviously I don't have any other word to use, or that or something else?
Sure, that's a great question. Keeping in mind, it's not just the pilot's testimony on an observation. Sure, when someone comes to you who's in charge of a multi-million dollar weapon platform who maintains a top secret security clearance, who is paid and trusted by this country to go fight wars and to fly over cities with live munitions. And by the way, they're trained observers with millions of dollars invested in their training.
Yep.
I would submit to you it's pretty compelling. But on top of that, it's not just the eyewitness testimony. It is actual electro-optical data and radar returns. It's also people like radar operators and air traffic controllers. So I think the discussion should be maybe a little bit broader than that. I think people are focusing just on two videos coming from a set of F-18s when really it's a lot more than that.
So we covered a lot of issues in that as I was playing that. What do you have any comments on any of that?
Well, Dr. Stephen Greer is a brilliant man, right? And well worth listening to any time. And as you know, George knew him, I think, fairly well. I know they spoke occasionally, and he always had the greatest respect for him. And it is true that Dr. Greer is trying to get out all the information. But isn't it what we were just saying about the government controlling through fear? And this is true. One of the fears they're going to use against us is we have to be fearful of all these extraterrestrials and band together and do as the government tells us. Otherwise, the boogeyman will come and get us. And, of course, that's really not true at all. The extraterrestrials that we really should be afraid of are the reptilians who are actually working with the government full time. So this lie has so many folds in it that I don't think you will ever get to the bottom of these lies, of these deceptions. And just going to where he spoke of all those planes over the White House, you know, the sightings over the White House way back when, in 1950, whatever it was.
52.
Those were the planes that are coming from the German factories, where they are being built with the Germans and the reptilians in charge under Antarctica. That's where they came from. And they came out, and as Dr. Seller records in one of his books about actions going on in Antarctica, they basically were giving a message to our government saying, you know, don't you dare attempt to do anything to us because you can't win. We are beating you hands down. And they were demonstrating that by flying into protective airspace over the White House. So this is all another part of the lie. The government doesn't want you to know not just that there are extraterrestrials, but that they themselves work hand in glove with them and with the remains of the Nazi Party from World War II. Down in Antarctica and also in Argentina and in Brazil, South America, the east side of South America predominantly is where you're going to find them. And our government has been literally hand in glove with them. And it's like close business partners and associates. And that's not just our general government, it's our army military. The ones that have set themselves separate from that are the Navy, our U.S. Naval Force. The U.S. Navy, not, so far as I understand it, in agreement with working with the Nazis, the Fourth Reich, but the Army are, and the generals are generally in the pay of that Fourth Reich group. And they, generally speaking, so far as we can determine, even the president doesn't know how deep that rabbit hole goes, but it goes very deep indeed, and is much worse in many ways than we can imagine. And yes, they will use fear of the extraterrestrials, but remember this, that all those UFOs, the round saucers, the disc-like UFOs, that unidentified flying objects are not coming from space. These are not alien craft coming, or very, very few of them. They are coming from the underground bases. They are coming from Antarctica, and they are built and controlled by the government and by the Germans, predominantly the Germans, and they are the offshoot of the German rocket experiments in World War II. And at that time, they developed a pilotless vehicle, which would have been seen as a UFO. And the design they used is this circular design, and it was given to them by their by a secret group, like the Skull and Bones type group, but in Germany, before World War II, called the Vril Group, V-R-I-L, they were spelled. And they worked with a psychic called Maria Orsic. And Maria Orsic is believed to have taken advantage of the skills of the Pleiadians to turn back time so that she's still alive and still looking very young, even though she was alive before World War II and a member of the Vril Society. She subsequently is believed to be with the Pleiadian group under the Antarctic and was in fact identified by a news person who went to interview her and who took a photo of her and showed it to Billy Meyer in Switzerland, where he identified her as the so-called Pleiadian named Semyasi, who fed him all the information that he got. And her partner is another German, member of the Vril Society, and that Vril Society, most of them were members of the Nazi Party, and they reported directly to Hitler with all this information about build and design of rockets and what we think of as UFOs, the circular spaceship thing. And they were the ones who also contacted George and asked him to publish the handbooks for him and dictated to him what went into those handbooks. So Maria Orsic and her cohort, who calls himself Quetzal, I don't know what his real name is, but she called herself Semyasi, called himself Quetzal, and they claim to be Pleiadians when in fact they are, he's German, and I think she was maybe Polish or something. I'm not sure of her nationality, but she was with the German Vril Society. They are the ones who are putting out all the information from the for the Pleiadians on this planet to persuade them that the Pleiadian way of life is the way we want to go. And the ships that they fly in and out with, that Billy Meyer so famously photographed for 20 years or more, those are built on the underground bases by the Germans and reptilians in Antarctica, and they are not spaceships. They are only landing craft, and those that come from actual extraterrestrials actually come out of a big spaceship that stays in space, and they are little landing craft that come down to the planet. The landing craft of real aliens probably represents less than 1% of all the craft that have been seen. 90% that are seen, including the V-shaped ones, the stealth planes that you see with the three. These are all out of what used to be Area 51. That's not there anymore. It used to be Area 51 from our government and also from the Germans. That's where they all come from. But the government is going to tell you that it's an invasion from space, and you better do what they tell you. Again, an excuse to bring in martial law. Fill you with fear and find an excuse for martial law, and that's it. The game's over. We humans have then become, we become slaves on our own planet.
Okay.
You know, they're taking humans as slaves on Mars for the mining of ore on Mars. And my understanding is that the Clinton Foundation are the biggest owners of those mines, and they're using slave labor on Mars. The Germans are using, reptilians are using slave labor under Antarctica by the tens of thousands. And if the government has their way, eventually we will become slaves on our own planet. And then they'll be telling us which mines we have to go and dig in and what we have to do and what we can and cannot have. So that's just, you know, just the way it's going. Sadly.
Okay.
But Dr. Greer is absolutely right. Listen to Dr. Greer.
Of course, yeah. He has that unacknowledged, which people should watch, and Project Disclosure. And he's been working at it for at least 35, 40 years, really a very accomplished individual. But in closing, getting close now, and I'm sorry to keep you so long, but let's talk about Operation Paperclip. Just briefly give, a lot of people don't know what happened right after World War II with the Germans. Can we talk about that briefly?
Right, right. Well, according to Dr. Sellers' records, and these are well documented with documentation that he managed to get through the Information Act, Access to Information Act, and are reprinted many of these in his book, right? But also what I know about paperclip, at the end of World War II, there were thousands of German scientists who had been working on all their armaments, their military, their V rockets, these UFO-type vehicles. And when the Russians moved into Germany and the Americans moved in, they were racing against each other to grab as many of these scientists as they could. So America got the first group and brought over, and they were just a relatively small group, and we're very, you know, familiar with those that went to White Sands, Oppenheimer, and his colleagues that were doing the atom bomb stuff, right? So we all know about that. But then there was a second surge called Paperclip, where we grabbed many more. And in Paperclip, there were not a few hundred. There were, I understand, thousands of people that were technical people, not just the pure scientists, but technical people that the Americans grabbed up and shipped back to America. And they subsequently sorted through them all. And the ones that were they felt were less useful to them, they sent back to Germany for the reconstruction that was going on in Germany after World War II. It was amazing what was going on there. My uncle, who was in the British Air Force, was the commander of a city called Geilenkirchen. And he said you couldn't believe how much money the Americans were pouring in for reconstruction in Germany after the war. Well, of course, you realize with hindsight that, yes, we could expect this because deals had been made with Hitler and his cadre that they would be escaped down to Argentina and Brazil, and under the big factories went under the Antarctic. And that it had taken Hitler two years, the last 2 years of the war, all he was doing was shipping stuff down to the Antarctic. So it was continuously, his factory base was up and running. But the paperclip people that were left here were then given positions in corporations and companies, amongst them companies like Martin Lockheed, that most recently was bought over from Boeing. And those German engineers continued the engineering work that they were doing in Germany in a division of Martin Lockheed, developing the kind of engines needed for those vehicles that we call UFOs, the flying saucers, right? I've forgotten the name of the There was one there the Germans had actually developed, and it had a specific name. And they brought that technology over, and it was redeveloped and expanded on at Martin Lockheed. Martin Lockheed recently has been, as you probably know, taken over by Boeing, and it's all part of that one corporation. But these German scientists were spread about, and technical people were spread about throughout our industries. And that's why maybe some of you have heard me say before that the military-industrial complex that we have, and I include Big Pharma now in this, in the last 25, 30 years, Big Pharma has taken over as the biggest moneymaker, right, alongside the tech industry. And it's all being run now by these people who were, the majority of whom, were card-carrying members of the Nazi Party and still hold those kind of philosophies. They still hold the philosophy of the Aryan race. The Germans are fundamentally an Aryan race. This means that they are white people, and that they are, well, Hitler's goal was to make an Aryan Europe, to get rid of everybody who was not of the Aryan race. So Aryan meant essentially the white race. You know, anybody who was not like that was sent to the concentration camps. They were got rid of. Whether you were Jewish or Gypsy or you were a political enemy, off you went to the concentration camps and they got rid of you if they could. Now, we have those people with that philosophy in most of our top industries today. One of them, of course, which is my favorite aggravation, is Dr. Fauci, who has headed up all the COVID programs, telling everybody what shots they have to have and how many times they have to have them, and that they have to wear masks and rebreathe their own bacteria all day long instead of fresh air. Dr. Fauci has actually made it his lifelong career in eugenics. That's what he has studied and is what he is an expert in. Following in the footsteps of Mengele, who did the experiments in the concentration camps, and prior to that, way back into the 1800s, the German scientists and doctors who were leading towards perfecting an Aryan race to rule the world with, and that was Hitler's goal. Hegemony in Europe was his intention, and that the white race should rule, the Aryan race should rule everything. And so this continues today, and the concepts of it continue throughout our military-industrial complex and throughout Big Pharma, headed up by Dr. Fauci, of course. So this is a nasty, nasty state or history that we are choosing to follow. We're way, way down the wrong path in our thinking. We need to have a rethink about our values. And there I would go right back to the beginning, to the Dalai Lama, and say, yes, we do need a new set of values laying out, and we need to switch our thinking into that new set of values. Because right. What we have currently is, quite frankly, in my view, it's evil. Every direction that we're pushed in through control and government, I think, is way, way down the dark side. And that is being led by the reptilian and their cohorts under Antarctica and in the other places where they locate. And you quite rightly said they're shapeshifters. So who knows how many humans are actually reptilian.
If you meet them on the street, you don't know who they are.
Right, you don't. It's true.
Okay. All right.
I've only ever seen two in my life. I have seen two.
Okay. Two humans
who were reptilian.
I think Kennedy was talking about that toward the end of his life. And I'll just let you comment on this as we close the program for the day.
Kennedy. The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know.
And that's why he was killed, right? Kennedy's Last Stand, the title of the book. Okay. You take a couple of minutes and close us out. Thank you very much for all the information. I didn't mean to keep you so long, but I wanted to cover a lot of information that a lot of people have not heard and that you have a great knowledge of. So that's why I kept you this long.
Well, as always, it's a great pleasure to talk with you, Russell. And I hope maybe next time we talk, we can talk about something really good instead of all this negative stuff that we've hit into today. I don't think that we're negative. I don't think that I am. But the material can be pretty depressing, right, sometimes when you think about all the evil that is out there. But, you know, there is another way for all of us, and that's what was spelled out in the book Saving Jesus by Dr. Michael Ledwith. And maybe another day we can talk about that and what we can actually do as individuals to change our lives, to make them better, and to make them the way they're supposed to be.
Okay. So we have to work toward that eventual happening.
We will have our work cut out, but for those of us who are asking the questions, who are open to the answers, and who are seeking the truth, which we are, all of us, if we are genuinely seeking the truth, I promise you there is a great outcome at the end. That the story doesn't end with the bad guys winning, because they don't win. They will not win, and their time is running out. So I am highly excited and optimistic about what is coming to this planet. And it might be a rough road for a little while, but it is going to get a whole lot better.
Well, great. Thank you very much for being here once again. And thank you for staying so long today. And so we'll talk next time, okay? Saving Jesus, the good book.
Okay.
I led with. Okay. Have a good one. Thank you now.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye now.